This episode is brought to you by GhostBed. We were just out of town at an Airbnb, and it was a nice enough place, but I slept horribly. I am a hot sleeper. I'm basically hot all the time. And the issue was that it got so warm that I kept waking up all night long. It was pretty miserable. And the thing is, we were in Leadville, Colorado. It's actually pretty cool up there. It's up at 10,000 feet and it's like temperature cool. So we opened up the windows, we had a fan blowing. Get this, it was 62 degrees inside. It was actually like pretty cool. And I was still waking up all through the night. The problem is it was a cheap mattress. And if I could give advice to that Airbnb owner, I would tell them to upgrade the mattresses and get a GhostBed Lux. GhostBed has patented cooling technology and the Lux is the coolest rating in their line of mattresses. And the thing is, the Lux is a little bit softer than the classic mattress. And I actually tested the one that Carl and Mindy have, and it was a little too firm with the classic for my comfort level. So the Lux is the one that I actually prefer. Now, if you're not sure which mattress to get, you can take their sleep quiz. The thing is, they have a full range and they even have massaging mattresses, and it uses an air pressure massage. Now, don't worry though, you have a 101 night at home sleep trial, and you actually can go check out everything that they have over at GhostBed. They have a full range of products, including adjustable bases, they have bedding, they have pillows, anything you need to sleep better. You could save 50% with the code MILEHIFI at checkout, or you could just go to ghostbed.com/milehifi and save 50% site-wide. Hey, what's going on? Welcome to the Mile High Fi podcast. I'm Doug Cunnington, and today I have a special guest, Jesse Kramer. Jesse, how's it going today?
Hey, Doug, it's going well. How are you, man?
It's good to see you. It's been a little while, but we've actually hung out in person a few times at FinCon, and it's been, I think we shared some beers once.
So absolutely. FinCon Austin, for sure, we shared some beers, and then I know we crossed paths in New Orleans. New Orleans was a little foggier for me. Maybe same for you.
It's all a blur. We're getting old, yeah. So it's hard to remember. But Jesse, you're the pen and voice behind The Best Interest. That is a blog and podcast going beyond the basics of personal finance and investing. And after a decade of aerospace engineering, you switch careers and now you work with clients at a fiduciary wealth management firm in Rochester, New York. You enjoy reading, long walks on the beach, I think on the beach, racket sports, and helping foster dogs with your wife and your baby daughter. So welcome to the show. And today we're going to talk about the crushing cost of conservative retirement planning. And we're going to go through a lot of the details and the issues with that. But for the people that don't know you, can you talk a little bit about your transition from engineering into this wealth management role that you have now?
Yeah, totally, Doug. Thank you for that introduction. And yes, we're going to get into some of the engineering concepts today with this crushing cost article, I think, or this concept. But okay, as far as the transition goes, I mean, the quick story is, yeah, I have a couple degrees, mechanical engineering, worked for a pretty well-known defense contractor for 7 or 8 years after the 6 years of college. And about midway through that time, so here I am, I'm like 25, 26, earning a reasonable salary, but really didn't know what I should be doing with it, which I think is something that probably a lot of people can relate to at some point in their financial journey is I'm making enough money, but maybe I'm not saving enough, or why aren't my accounts going up, or how should I be paying down my debt? Should I be putting it in my 401k? You know, all these different options. So I went through just a lot of self-study, and I kind of became hooked on this kind of content, whether it's listening to podcasts like this one, reading FI blogs, reading all the famous books and titles that we've all probably heard of. And then something about my engineering mind just said, you know, how do I break these down into simple terms? Maybe I got a little bit lucky genetically or environmentally. My parents are both teachers, so I really enjoy explaining things and trying to understand something so as, you know, how to teach it. At some point, I was sitting there at my engineering desk. This is about 3 summers ago, so call it 2021. And I just said, the thing that excites me the most is when I get my emails from my readers or my listeners saying, hey, Jesse, could you explain this concept? Or even better, here's my financial situation. What kind of advice do you recommend to me? And I just thought to myself, how do I do more of this? So I had a bunch of conversations locally here in Rochester and loved the one that I had with the firm that I currently work with. And right, so we're a fiduciary financial planning and wealth management firm, everything from, you know, if you're familiar with what CFPs do, you know, if you're listening to this and you know what the kind of services and expertise that CFPs can provide, that's what we do. So it's tons of fun. I love working with clients and I'm still able to write and podcast on a regular basis.
Perfect. And I guess like it actually fits really well from a marketing standpoint for you to do those two things because maybe folks want to eventually work with your company, right?
Yeah, I mean, totally. My MO is that, you know, the best interest is full of free, helpful content, solving problems that I would solve anyway for work. And I heard something recently, Doug, it was Michael Kitsis, who's a very famous kind of CFP blogger, was talking with the white coat investor, Jim Dolly. And Michael broke it down. He said these consumer studies show that maybe a third of people out there are like pretty hardcore DIYers. Like they know enough, they're confident enough, they don't really need to consult with a professional. Another third are what they call validators. And these are people who they're going to want second opinions. Maybe they don't want someone to really take over the reins fully, but they want second opinions. And that's where something like an hourly CFP or like a flat fee project CFP might make sense. But then the final third are delegators. And whether they're really comfortable with finances and they just want to free up their time, or maybe they just have no idea what's going on, but there, something I've learned, because I came from the DIY route that you and I are familiar with, where it's like, yeah, you learn this stuff, you figure out how to do it on your own, and then you do it. And what's the big deal? I've learned that there are plenty of people out there who have zero interest in that, or they're just way too busy for that, and they deserve to have some sort of fair arrangement where they're getting great help, they're not paying some sort of exorbitant fee, and hopefully everybody wins. So that's what I'm trying to do.
Perfect. And before we get into the topic, I was going to say that we ended up hiring a CFP. And I think maybe when we talked off air, I had mentioned it a little bit, like we went through a process and interviewed several people. And then eventually, like we needed to get some outside help for validation primarily. Even though like my wife and I are both engineers, we actually have a pretty good handle and can scrutinize like whatever plan we got back, like we could really tear it apart if we wanted to. But we did tear some things apart yeah. And ask a lot of questions. Like some people do want the validation. It's just like a professional can see this hundreds or dozens of times and we're only doing this once. We don't have a lot of experience. So it's like, it is valuable. And I know as a previous DIYer, accumulating is much easier than figuring out how to spend and all that. But when I was DIYing, it did seem like it would be crazy to pay thousands of dollars to do this. And, you know, it's a fee only situation. So it's very clear like what we get, what the deliverables are, and it's not assets under management. So, okay. Very good. So with this conservative retirement planning, I think it's an interesting topic because a lot of people, the general population, they overspend, they don't save enough. Like we're a weird group. If you're listening to this, you're weird like Jesse and I, and there's a strong chance you're potentially way too conservative with your planning. So Jesse, why is this an issue? And can you talk about some of the costs that we're talking about and like why this could be a major problem?
Yeah. I mean, we can get right into the financial side of this. Cause in my original thought process, I will say, you know, for 60 seconds of background, when I was in aerospace engineering, we designed and built and tested satellite telescope systems. And when you're designing, I mean, think for example, the James Webb Space Telescope that many of you might be familiar with. It went up, what, a couple years ago? We did a lot of the assembly and integration and test of that telescope as a subcontractor to NASA. And when you have a $15 billion telescope system, you really want to make sure you get it right, right? You only really have one chance to get it right. And therefore, if you ever have the opportunity to be conservative in your assumptions, you should be conservative. right? You don't want to be overly aggressive in any assumptions in that case. But the problem is that from an engineering point of view, that all these what are called factors of safety, which is like how much conservatism do you smear onto this math that you're doing, when you apply lots of different conservative factors of safety, they have a multiplicative effect. So they compound. You can think of it as compounding. And what you end up with is an overall factor of safety for the whole project that is really, really high. And therefore, you have to make your design much stronger or bulkier or more expensive than maybe you really need to, but you just really want to make sure that it's safe. So the problem is that if you apply that same line of thinking to, say, retirement planning, you might end up in a situation where it's like, sure, your retirement plan could survive the worst financial disaster in recorded history and then some. But what's most likely going to happen is that you're going to live a fairly run-of-the-mill retirement and you're going to end up with way more money at death than you really need. And what really is the upshot is that you probably could have retired many, many years sooner if you had simply had a more normal approach to retirement as opposed to this conservatism. So that's a little bit of the background, Doug. Yeah, I mean, what I did, and I'll just keep it really short and then I'll throw it back to you and we can take this any way you want to go. But I looked at Social Security assumptions, investment return assumptions, the assumptions around what someone would spend, their expenses in retirement. And then I looked at inflation and tax rates. Like these are these five major moving pieces in retirement planning that if you want to, you can be conservative or aggressive along the spectrum of assumptions there. And then I looked at those five different categories and I kind of tweaked them. I dialed them up from aggressive to conservative. And I wanted to see when could someone safely retire depending on how conservative I am.
Do you want to give some specific examples just to illustrate? Because when we talk about it conceptually and it's like, if some people say, hey, we're going to get 10% returns and then other people are like, maybe it'll be 7%. Or my wife is very conservative. So we actually butted heads quite a lot. And our advisor is also sort of a intermediary and a person that can bring some order and make sure that, you know, he does what we're paying him for. And part of that is like helping us navigate these debates, which we weren't navigating very well on our own. She might be like, we should go with 5%. And I'm like, what if we go with 8%? And she's like, more like 5%. So yeah, what impact does it actually have? And you could run through like, you know, conservative versus the more aggressive. And then like maybe the average that we're potentially looking at. And then we'll have a little debate because some of them I'm like, I don't know if I agree with you on these. So yeah, what does it look like with real numbers?
Totally, totally. Let's start with what I would label this as being unreasonably conservative. So here are my set of assumptions for someone who's unreasonably conservative. But what I do think is for those of you listening, these are all assumptions that maybe you've seen before. Maybe you feel them yourself. At the very least, you've read them on the FIRE Facebook groups or subreddits. Like these are things that you'll see people say things like this for Social Security. The unreasonably conservative assumption is to assume that it won't exist for you. Okay. For investment returns, well, stocks historically return, say, 10%. Bonds might return historically in the range of 5%. A 60-40 portfolio, therefore, returns something like 9% per year over long periods of time. But if you're going to be ultra-conservative or too conservative, you'd say, well, 6 to 7% return from like a 60-40 portfolio. But then inflation, because that's nominal, right? That's not inflation adjusted yet. So 6 or 7% without inflation. Historically, inflation has been about 3% per year. But a conservative assumption would tick that up to say 5% per year, especially after 2022 and 2023. It's understandable why someone might make that type of conservative assumption there. Spending. Okay, most retirees' nominal spending actually goes down during retirement. But a conservative person would try to play it safe and they would assume that their spending goes up. So in my particular example, I assumed that someone's spending went up by 25%, or at least that was the assumption that they were baking into their retirement plan. And then last, tax rates. The conservative assumption is to assume that federal tax rates are going to increase across the board. And thus, the personal tax rate, the retiree's personal tax rate will increase. And so I used a 20% effective tax rate for this analysis. And then what I did, and I'll do the same thing for the aggressive assumptions and then the middle of the road assumptions was I took these assumptions, threw them in a spreadsheet, and I looked at a 50-year-old person who currently has $100,000 in their retirement accounts. They're earning 100 grand per year, and they're spending about 75 grand per year. And so that was my initial conditions. If you're a math or engineering,
quick correction. I think you had a million in retirement accounts, right?
Oh, I might have misspoken. Yes, yes, that's exactly right. A million in retirement accounts, earning 100,000 per year, spending 75K per year. Apologies, I misspoke. So those are my initial conditions. Then I add in those conservative assumptions that I just discussed, and that person can safely retire at age 76. Today they're 50. They could safely retire at age 76 with my ultra conservative assumptions. So then if I go to, it depends on how you look at it. My most aggressive set of assumptions, what I did here in this article, but for what it's worth on these aggressive assumptions, they are no different than historical averages. All I did was I said the future is going to exactly resemble the past in terms of what historical averages have been. So Social Security will exist. And based on this person's income history, it'll likely pay them about $2,500 per month. Their 60-40 retirement portfolio will return 9% per year. Inflation, though, will be 3% per year. So their real return will be 9 minus 3, right? That's 6% per year. Their expenses will drop in retirement by about 10%. And their effective tax rate will be about 7.5%. And that's at the federal level, right? I didn't look at state taxes for what it's worth. Now, using the same exact initial conditions, a 50-year-old, a million in retirement accounts, earning 100K, spending 75K per year, that person with the hyper real or the most aggressive assumptions could retire at about age 55. So my conservative person retires at age 76. My hyper real slash aggressive person retires at age 55. It's 21 years of difference.
Crazy.
And then, yeah, it is. And I mean, that right there, that's the crushing cost, in my opinion, of conservative retirement planning. It's two decades of more work than you had to do. But Doug, even if someone's listening to this and they're like, all right, Jesse, I understand that those are the actual realistic historical conditions, but can't I just dial a little bit of conservatism in there? Which I actually do think is smart. Like, I don't think it's smart to simply assume that the future will be exactly like the past. So I dialed a tiny bit of conservatism in there. And the real quick breakdown is, for Social Security, I assumed that 80% of what is promised will be delivered to the retiree. So instead of $2,500 a month, they're getting $2,000 a month. I used 8% as the return on the 60-40 portfolio, minus 3.5% for inflation. I assumed that they would spend exactly the same amount in retirement as they do during their working years. And I used a effective tax rate at the federal level of 10%, up from 7.5%. And that hypothetical 50-year-old with the 1 million in retirement accounts, et cetera, they could retire in about 9 years at age 59.
Okay.
Which still is what, 16, 17 years better than the conservative subject.
Right. Okay. So perfect illustration. And quick note for the Social Security assuming 80%. So my understanding is, actually, I'll let you explain it because you are the teacher here. So why 80%?
Why 80? Yeah. So listeners might be familiar with headlines saying that Social Security Trust is going to run out of money in 2034. And that's actually true. But we need to dig a little bit deeper to understand what that means. So right now we're sitting here in 2024, Doug. And as it stands today, about 90% of the checks that go out of the Social Security Administration to retirees, 90% of them are covered by the Social Security payroll taxes that people like you and I pay. The remaining 10% of those checks going out, that money is coming from the Social Security Trust. And based on the amount of people who are retiring and the amount of Social Security they're going to be collecting and all that kind of actuarial math, the actuaries actually are saying, right, if things don't change, the trust will run out of money by about 2034. Give or take a couple years. And at that point, that 90-10 ratio that I described, it's slowly going to start to shift closer to something like 80-20. And so if the trust actually runs out without anybody in legislation doing anything about it, then we're going to have the situation in that time frame, 2034, 2035, where there's no more trust to cover that 20% of the checks going out. And therefore, what's likely to happen is that people like you and I are only going to receive about 80% of the benefit that's promised to us. So it's not great. It's not great.
Yeah.
It's also not the complete nightmare that if you didn't know better, you'd see the headline, Social Security runs out of money, and you're like, nightmare scenario, $0. No, it's 80%. It's not right. They made a promise, but it's not a nightmare.
Right. And then it just works like a normal Ponzi scheme, right? Where the,
to some the extent.
New investors. I mean, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the big concern totally is, you know, what if population decline occurs? What if fewer people are paying in? It's not ideal.
Right. Okay. So basically, it looks like, you know, most of the factors that you've outlined, I'm like, yeah, I can go with you on that. But the expenses, I think, perhaps depend on when someone retires. So your argument, you know, you literally wrote in the blog post what my argument might be is like, oh, I want to travel a lot. I'm going to say it's going to go up 25%, which in our projections, like we were like, it's not going to be ongoing, right? Like we understand there's going to be time buckets that we need to figure out. So probably maybe for like 10 to 15 years, we're like 45. So 10 or 15 years, like we potentially could be traveling pretty hard. And then I think our expenses could go down. What, obviously, you know the industry well, and retirees do spend less. However, I'm stubborn. I think I'm a special snowflake like everyone else. And I'm like, well, I enjoy spending money. I have, you know, expensive hobbies. So why am I wrong, Jesse? Like, how wrong am I?
Well, wrong, I'm not sure I'd color it in right and wrong, Doug. You know, you spend your money the way you want to. But I think the idea is that if you look at the average working person, and that this spans from whether they're 25 to 60 or 65, whatever it may be, like one of the biggest differences is something like a mortgage payment. Well, you know, most retirees are paying less in housing than the average working person is paying. Now, so I say, you know, if you compare when they're age 62 pre-retirement to age 63 post-retirement, well, maybe in both those ages, they've had their paid off mortgage, and maybe the 63-year-old retiree wants to travel a lot more and eat out at nicer restaurants, et cetera, et cetera. And so maybe they will spend more than they spent at age 62. But, you know, whether it's the daily commute, whether it's the cost of working itself, you know, I've got to buy nice suits or whatever it may be, whether it's, you know, there are certain expenses like that that can tend to disappear in retirement or tend to go down in retirement. But what I will say, it's not uncommon for me to hear someone say, you know, our day-to-day lifestyle is going to be exactly the same, except we're going to go on two $15,000 trips per year. So yeah, I mean, retirement is going to be more expensive, at least for a while. There's a great saying, boy, let me see if I can remember it. The go-go, the slow-go, and the no-go years. Are you familiar with this?
Yes.
So what is it? It's like this, the, you know, the early years of retirement are go-go and people's spending might go up. And then as they age and physically they don't feel it, they have the slow-go years where, you know, right, they maybe are spending a little more time at home. And eventually you reach a point where you really don't want to travel at all and you don't really want to do much at all when it comes to like expensive, high-octane activities. And then your spending is probably going to be significantly lower.
The interesting part is most of these factors are outside of our control. Social Security, investment returns, inflation, tax rates, like we just take what we get. The expenses are the only one that you do control. So
yeah,
it is interesting that that's one of the ones where people will overestimate. And one thing that's not in here, also mystery factor, healthcare. So my wife was in the healthcare industry. She was super concerned about how much that was going to cost. Do you have any thoughts on that? So no clean question, but that is one of those uncontrollable, super unknown things. And the healthcare inflation is, I can't remember how many times of compared to the average inflation, it's just out of control, right? So any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think for FI folks in particular, that is a really big question mark, because it'd be one thing for me to say, well, just wait till you're 65 and go on Medicare, and then a lot of your problem is solved. But you're right, if you're retiring in your 40s, I mean, that's a really big question mark that you need to answer for yourself. And I think part of it is just baking in the cost of some out-of-pocket coverage into your plan, which it's a lot, right? That's a big bite to take. But then, I mean, when I look at you, for example, Doug, like you're physically fit. And I don't know how much of that was intentional, was genetic, was just you enjoy fitness and therefore you've always kind of been fit. But, and it's a bit of a trope too, because you never know what the genetic lottery is going to throw your way. But there's no doubt about it, right? If I took 1,000 clones of Doug and I said, you 500 guys, you're going to sit on the couch all day and eat McDonald's. The other 500 Dougs are going to live healthy lifestyles like the ones you're living. And then I wait 10 years and just look at how everybody is faring. Sure, some of the healthy Dougs might have screwed up somehow and got unlucky and befallen some terrible illness. And some of the McDonald's Dougs, for some reason, are doing fine. But on average, there's no doubt about it. The McDonald's Dougs are going to have much higher healthcare costs. So the point being, the only thing you can control in that case, you can't control unlucky genetics that, you know, might give you some terrible disease, but you can control what you put in your mouth, and you can control whether or not you're going to climb Mount Elbert. You do the best you can and you try to keep your healthcare costs low that way. And you cross your fingers and you hope that the American system changes in your benefit.
Well said. That would be a creepy world with 1,000 clones of me, but Your point was well made. Okay. So we understand the issues, and like most things, like there's a sort of an extreme version on each side. Somewhere mm-hmm. in the middle is probably the best route. The great part in one of the great debates that, you know, people look at, like the 4% rule or other pieces, like when things kind of start going wrong, your projections are off. Like we will probably have, I don't know, 15 to 20 years of like insight on that. So we could adjust course. And like I said, you can control the expenses to some extent, depending on how aggressive or conservative you've made your plan. So you could adjust along the way and kind of true it up as you go along, which is great. But when people are looking at this and we've identified the problem, we understand the different factors. Maybe there's some sub factors in there that we can address specifically, or a person can address specifically. How can we take this information and not be emotional about it and make a plan that is a little bit more in the middle?
It can be really hard. It can be really hard. And something I've learned over time is it is so dependent on the person themselves. And there's a reason why I learned this recently, that CFP curriculum is actually now, there is a, I think they call it financial psychology. There's now a financial psychology component of CFP curriculum. Some people in that CFP world are considering whether almost like a marriage counseling like subunit should be part of the curriculum as well. Or just like an interpersonal counseling therapy type curriculum, because you could present the same exact scenario. I mean, as you've kind of alluded to, Doug, right? You can present the same numbers to two different people and get vastly different reactions from them, or vastly different input from them on whether it's too much risk or not enough risk, or too much conservatism or not enough conservatism. So to some extent, it's the way I interpret that question, Doug, is if you have, say, a person who can't quite convince themselves that the numbers work out, or you have two people who can't quite get on the same page as to whether the numbers work out. I mean, that is the situation where in one way or another, it can be helpful to lean on a third party. It can be helpful to say, share your story with anonymously with like a Facebook FI group, share your story with a financial independent subreddit, share your numbers with part of being a fiduciary, like a advisor, a CFP, a planner, whatever you might be, is saying, hey, I'm going to make a dispassionate review of your numbers. And simply it's like the great, what they say is, if you're a referee or an umpire, like I call them like I see them. I'm going to tell you what I see if you tell me your numbers dispassionately. So one way or another, I think it can be helpful in those cases to take your own monkey brain, lizard brain out of it, because we all have one, right? We all have these biases or assumptions or reactions or instincts that don't always do us favors when it comes to financial planning or investing. And sometimes it helps, it's take your personal emotions out of it one way or another. And usually that involves, in some way, leaning on outside opinions.
With, you kind of alluded to it before, but with risk, everyone does deal with it a little bit differently. And you can have the exact same scenario and two people are going to be like, oh, this is so risky. I can't believe you're doing that. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, like, if we do have flexibility in our plan, it allows us to adapt when we need to. Do you have any experience or other thoughts on, you know, understanding the risk and someone dealing with the risk, even though maybe they're very scared and they're, you know, fearful of like worst case scenarios, and giving them the confidence that like, hey, you can adapt. You're going to have probably, you know, like 10 or 15 years to adjust course a little bit. And like, say we're writing down these projections, like they're written in stone, but like, we're going to be changing this every, whatever, 6 months or 18 months or whatever you and your advisor work on or whatever you're deciding if you're DIYing. So just mm-hmm. dealing with risk, fear, and knowing that you actually can adapt and it's not written in stone.
Yeah. I mean, that topic right there, I think it might be my favorite topic to write and talk about, is this concept of, right, you know, how do you mentally approach the idea of investing, understanding the risks going in? Because in my opinion, I think the FI community, and sometimes they underestimate the amount of risk presented to them by the stock market, especially because the FI community really has grown up during the last 15 years, this tailwind of a bull market. And so some of my favorite articles to write, I'm not trying to be this like doomsaying pessimist at all. Like, I am very pro stocks, and such a huge amount of my personal net worth is in the stock market. But at the same time, I'm aware that there have been these spells before of essentially zero return in the stock market. Like, I think you can draw a line from, I think it's like 1998 through 2013. And if you adjust for inflation, there's essentially no return in the stock market, something like that. And you're like, whoa, that's a 15-year period where, yes, if you were dollar cost averaging into the market that whole time, well, now you're sitting here and you're so glad you did. But if ostensibly, if you had lumped sum at the worst time possible in 1998, and you just sat there with your, you know, hands under your butt for the next 15 years, and inflation adjusted, you didn't make a single dollar. And I'm not sure people understand that that's the other side of the stock market coin. Our last 15 years have been amazing. But anyway, to answer your actual question, Doug, and this is a simple heuristic that I think helps some people conceptualize the amount of risk they're holding. Let's think of a typical retiree who, again, and this is coming from kind of the planner in me, a very simplistic but tried and true retirement portfolio is the 60-40 portfolio. Great. So let's have 60% of our money in, you know, VT and 40% of our money in BND, the Vanguard Bond Index Fund. And then at the same time, we also know this thing, the 4% rule, right? The 4% rule, which otherwise says you should have 25 times your annual expenses saved up. So now I'm going to combine all those numbers into one. If I've achieved the 4% rule and I'm now FI and ready to retire, and I'm in a 60-40 portfolio, well, then that means I have about 15 years of expenses in stocks, right? That's 60% of 25. I have 10 years of expenses rather in bonds. That's the 40. And then, okay, now let's get back to risk. The stock market does something terrible, and the 60 side of our portfolio does something terrible, and it feels bad, and we don't like it. Well, it can be helpful to remember that you still have 10 years of bonds. And most likely, I mean, there are times, 2022 being one example, where the stock market and the bond market behave in a similar way at the same time, but that's pretty uncommon. And most likely, whatever caused the stock side of your portfolio to drop likely did not affect your bond portfolio in the same way. And it can be really assuring to say, you know, I know it feels a little bit scary right now and you might want to panic and do something, but you have 10 years of buffer, of ballast right here. And you can wait for years and let the stock side of your portfolio recover. Or if someone's really into it, which hopefully we can convince them of this, you might even want to rebalance into stocks when they're down right now, which is probably even better. But either way, if you don't want to rebalance into stocks, you've got 10 years to wait and you'll be okay. So I think looking at your portfolio, not in terms of raw dollar and cents performance, but rather as saying, I've got different asset classes that are there for different timelines. And my lower risk assets, cash or bonds, are there for the years most close to us, the near term years, right? Whether it's 4, 6, 8 years worth of cash and bonds. And the stocks, the higher risk stuff, that's for way out in the future. And so even if the stocks take a short term dip right now, from a risk point of view, I know that I'm okay for the near term because of my safer asset classes. So that's a helpful heuristic that I think people, it's easy for people to conceptualize that.
I think you're right about the FI community maybe overinvesting in equities just because it has been so good. And like you said, they kind of grew up together. And well, I think you've done way more research and you have certifications and you're far more qualified. But I am definitely a little bit more on the aggressive side compared to my wife. But she recently retired and she is literally, as we speak, like working on rebalancing pretty close. I don't think it's quite 40% on her end. And then again, mine's more aggressive. I think I maybe have like 10 or 12% on the bond side. So like, as we put them together, again, we end up more sort of in the middle of the road. And I think between the two of us, like we feel comfortable with that allocation overall. But like, if you could share, can you tell us what your makeup is right now?
Yeah, totally. If I were to look at, and this combines myself and my wife, it takes out our primary home as real estate. And if we're only looking at investable assets, so that's, you know, 401ks, IRAs, taxable brokerage accounts, I would wager that we're probably 75 to 80% stocks, probably 5 to 8% alternatives. And I can get into a little bit of that. And that includes a tiny sliver of crypto. And then the remainder, which might be what, 15 or so percent. 18%, something like that, in cash and bonds. And that cash, for what it's worth, I mean, that includes like our emergency fund, you know, that kind of thing. So if you take that out too, we're probably somewhere close to like 80, 20, 85, 15, something like that. And for reference, we're 34 years old, maybe halfway to our FI number, something like that. So I'd anticipate us, you know, even if we wanted to RE as soon as possible, you know, we've got a young baby at home and that complicates things, but still we're, call us halfway to our FI journey.
Got it. Okay. That makes sense. And I think we're probably pretty close on a percentage basis when you combine my wife and I. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay. So what are the alternative investments? So you said a little crypto. I got some timeshares. Yeah. Timeshares are great. No, I'm just kidding. No, I don't have any timeshares.
So the other idea, and this is, don't get me wrong, this is about as controversial as I get from an investing point of view. But the idea is, you know, do you want to seek out additional asset class diversification beyond stocks and bonds? And if you do, at what cost? Because listen, when you get beyond stocks and bonds, even if you're looking at things that are like cheap or passive or indexy, there can still be some higher than ideal expense ratios associated with them. But to give you an example of two of the alternative asset classes that are assets, I guess would be the best way to describe them, that I own. One is a reinsurance fund. And so reinsurance, imagine, Doug, that you own a home insurance company in the Southeast United States. The thing that would probably keep you up at night is a Category 5 hurricane that would damage a large number of your customers' homes, and then all those customers would be making claims all at once, and your insurance company has to send a whole bunch of money out all at once. So to protect yourself from that risk, you're going to go to an even bigger insurance company and get some sort of umbrella coverage, for lack of a better term, and no pun intended for the hurricanes fans out there. That's called reinsurance. It's a big insurance umbrella for an insurance company to protect against those risks. So you ask yourself, if you're investing in the reinsurance industry, what, you know, what affects the performance of a reinsurance company? The answer is it's natural disaster frequency and the reinsurer's ability to price that risk into the premiums that they charge. It really has very little to do with what's going on Wall Street. It has much more to do with, was this hurricane season worse or better than they anticipated? And so that lack of correlation to Wall Street, that's the genesis of diversification right there. Lack of correlation is the same as diversification. The second example is a timberland and farmland fund that, again, they own these giant swaths of forest in Maine where they grow trees over 40 years and then cut them down for paper and then plant more trees and the cycle continues. And you ask yourself, again, is the rate of tree growth in rural Maine associated with what's going on Wall Street? Not really. So that lack of correlation in behavior, that brings you additional diversification. So not something that I think everybody needs. And to be honest with you, I'm not even sure if I need it. I'm not positive. You know, for now, it's working out for me. And I think it's kind of interesting. And it's a fun thing to talk about here on a podcast.
Right. A tree farm. I had a friend who had his family had some property. And yeah, it was like 2,000 acres of a tree farm. And they had a little cabin. And it was kind of fun for them to have something a little bit different.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
I will say just one more note on that. Actually, two quick notes. The first one is, yeah, I mean, the devil's advocate in me is said, like, why do you need to make your portfolio additionally complex? I think that's a really good point. And I think for a lot of people out there, it's like, hey, if you don't need additional complexity, why? Why bother? Why go for it? So I do think there's a really good argument to be made there. And going back to something you said earlier, Doug, I just wanted to make an idea where you said, of the five categories in my article, pretty much only expenses were within your control. I agree with that. I will say that your tax rate is borderline in your control. And I think the more someone listening right now learns about how taxes work, especially in early retirement, the more empowered they'll feel that actually there are sometimes when they can control their tax rates reasonably well and do some really helpful tax planning for their future.
Awesome point. Yeah, I was just, as you were making the point, I was like, oh yeah, I missed that when like we have some Roth conversions we'll have to do in the next few years. And if you don't think about it, you can make a mistake and pay a little too much in taxes. So yeah, we do have some control on that.
Yeah.
That's why you're a pro, man. All right. So as we're wrapping up here, we covered the topic really well. We'll link up so people can take a look at the article that you wrote. But let's say someone is not sure if they are being too conservative or too aggressive. They probably should get an expert. They should hire a CFP for an hour or two and whatever they need to do to get an expert opinion. But let's say someone wants to DIY this maybe beforehand and we have a blind spot for our own intellectual plans. We have an issue like seeing these gaps. We're blind to it, right? It is our blind spots. Mm-hmm. So do you have any ideas or ways that people can have a look at their plan and just identify places where they are being conservative?
That's an interesting question. That's an interesting question. I don't know if this exactly answers the question as you intended, Doug, but one thing I think people can and should do is go to one of your trusted FI calculators, go in with what you consider to be your quote unquote normal assumptions, and then dial each one of them down by 20 or 30%. And see what that does to your plan, and then go back to normal and dial them up by 20 or 30% and see what that does with your plan. In other words, describe or define your own personal range of outcomes, as maybe I did in the article where I went from ultra conservative to perhaps too aggressive. And I said, boy, this 50-year-old person might retire in 5 years, or they might retire in 26 years. Like, that's one hell of a range of outcomes. And if I were that person, it would make me uncomfortable to have that wide of a range of outcomes. And I'd probably want to seek clarity. But if you do that what I just described, and you're like, well, if I'm really aggressive, I can retire in 3 years. If I'm really conservative, I can retire in 5 years. Well, that's a pretty small range of outcomes, and maybe it doesn't matter to you. When it comes to identifying individual blind spots, I just think the best thing a DIYer can do is just learn, and read, and listen, and you know, spend some time on the Facebook groups or the subreddits, and what are other people concerned about? What are other people planning for? I think that can be a really good way to say, like, oh shit, like, this person, I didn't even think about healthcare costs. I didn't even think about long-term planning in a nursing home. I didn't even think about, you know, do I need to set up trusts for my kid? Like, all whatever that concern is, I think seeing how other people do it in a crowdsourced way can be a really great place to start.
And it's amazing listening to, you know, shows like yours, Choose FI, or our other friends, Matt and Joel, How to Money. There's so many questions that come in and scenarios. You kind of could find yours or really close. I know people love to have their own question answered, and I do too. But at the same time, it's like there's a certain number of scenarios, and it's like that person's too aggressive, that person's too conservative, or they miss this one thing. And if you listen to enough of the shows, which I have, I think you have too, Jesse, like you're like, oh, I know the answer before the hosts get to it. A lot of times. So yeah. Tons of information out there, a lot of different scenarios. But yeah, if you lurk in the groups or listen to the shows or watch the videos on YouTube, you should be able to pick out something pretty close to yours most of the time.
Yeah. Yeah. And the one part of your answer I really like there, Doug, is the idea that if you listen to only one source, you know, a good example, because he's very popular. If you listen to only Dave Ramsey, and you bake in, I think his one thing that he caught some flack for, he definitely caught flack for his like 8% rule, but his 8% rule, I think, is based on mutual funds returning 12% per year to their investors. Now, I think you and I would say that's too aggressive. I think that's unrealistically aggressive. But if all you do is listen to Dave Ramsey, then maybe that's the one and only truth that you believe, and that's what you bake into your plan. And you say, ah, well, if only you maybe listen to three other voices or a cacophony of other voices. And sure, it can take a little bit of work, and it sometimes people are going to disagree with each other, and that leaves you wondering which one's right and which one's wrong. But that's how education occurs. And over time, you'll start to, I think, come to maybe a good balance in your own life of what you want to assume. So anyway, point being, Doug, I really like the advice of, yeah, listen to a few different voices and see what they have to say.
Well, your voice is a good one to listen to, Jesse. You have a show out there. Can you talk about some upcoming episodes?
Yeah. Yeah. The Best Interest Podcast, available wherever you listen to your podcasts. Hopefully, I think we're on all the major podcast players and YouTube. It's a semi-interview, semi-monologue show where I like to share interesting concepts in financial planning, in investing, breaking down sometimes some complex stuff into simple terms so that people can really digest it and walk away and apply it into their own lives. And most of my listeners, as far as I can tell, are DIYers who just want to learn more. And I love interacting with that audience. And boy, part two of your question does some exciting episodes that are coming up. I've got, for the FI specific folks, there's a gentleman out there, Steve Adcock is his name, who I think has been FI for maybe 8 or 10 years. He's got a pretty unique story. His episode might be coming out in a month or so. I'm not sure when this is airing, actually, Doug. So I'll say in mid-October, Steve's episode is coming out. But if you just want to dip your toe into the Best Interest Podcast, Doug's episode, January of 2023, go back, or 2024 rather, this year, check out Doug. Or the AMA episodes are always good ones. I feel like I get a lot of good feedback on the AMA episodes, which is, it's nothing but DIYers like yourselves asking questions and me putting together answers for them.
Very good. It's a great show. Yeah, check out my episode. We'll put a link so people can find it. And your blog's out there too. It's a great newsletter, so people should sign up for that. You send out weekly, is that right?
Yeah, yeah. So bestinterest.blog is the website. And yes, it's a weekly newsletter, short and sweet, contains my new content, as well as usually 4 to 6 links from around the internet of just other financial planning content that I've found particularly helpful that week.
Very good. Well, thanks, Jesse. We'll link up to all your stuff and appreciate your expertise.
Awesome. Thank you for having me on, Doug. This is a lot of fun.
Thanks for listening to the show. That was the Mile High Five podcast, and I'm Doug Cunnington. If you dig the show, please do three things for us. Number one, tell a friend, a family member, an enemy about the show. We really don't care who you tell. Maybe forward them a specific show that you know that they will like. It's the single most helpful thing that you can do to spread the word. It's like giving us a virtual high five, and actually we don't give high fives in person, so the virtual kind's pretty good. And more importantly, your friend or family member or even your enemy will appreciate the fact that you were thinking of them. Number two, make sure you're following or subscribed on your podcast app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, YouTube, whatever you're using, and that way you won't miss a show. And number three, please leave us a rating and review. We read them on the show occasionally, and you might hear yours out there on an upcoming episode. Quick disclaimer, this show is not financial or legal advice. I'd actually be surprised if it sounded like it. It's really just for entertainment, and that's at least what we're hoping for. But seriously, get advice from professionals. So we'll catch y'all next week.